Ahead, a judge was working at his bench as a few lawyers shuffled paperwork and bantered back and forth. To the right was the empty jury box. The high walls were covered with even more fading portraits. All men, all bearded, and apparently serious about legal matters. A couple of clerks chatted and flirted with the lawyers. Several spectators watched and waited for justice to prevail. Annette cornered a prosecutor, a man she hurriedly introduced to her intern as Richard, and said they represented Phoebe Fanning, who would be filing for divorce as soon as possible. "How much do you know?" she asked Richard. The three moved to a corner near the jury box so no one could hear. Richard said, "According to the cops, they were both stoned and decided they ought to settle their differences with a good fight." He won. She lost. Somehow a gun was involved, unloaded, and he whacked her in the head with it. Annette recounted Phoebe's version as Richard listened carefully. He said, "Hump's his lawyer, and all he wants now is a low bond. I'll argue for a higher one, and maybe we can keep this old boy in jail a few more days, let him cool off while she clears out." Annette nodded, agreed, and said, "Thanks, Richard." Humph was Cal Humphrey, a fixture from down the street. They had just walked past his storefront office. Annette said hello and introduced Samantha, who was appalled at the size of his stomach. A pair of gaudy suspenders strained under the load and seemed ready to pop, with consequences that would be too gross to consider. Hump whispered that his man, Randy, for a second he could not remember his last name, needed to get out of jail because he was missing work. Hump didn't buy Phoebe's version of events, but instead suggested that the entire conflict had been started when she attacked his client with the unloaded pistol. "That's why we have trials," Annette mumbled as they eased away from Hump. Randy Fanning and two other inmates were escorted into the courtroom and placed on the front row. Their handcuffs were removed, and a deputy stood close. The three could have been members of the same gang. Faded orange jail overalls, unshaven faces, messy hair, hard looks. Annette and Samantha sat in the audience, as far away as possible. Barb tiptoed into the courtroom, handed Annette a file and said, "Here's the divorce." When the judge called Randy Fanning to the bench, Annette sent a text message to Phoebe, who was sitting in her car outside the courthouse. Randy stood before the judge, with Hump to his right and Richard to his left, but farther away. Hump began a windy narrative about how much his client needed to be at work, how deep his roots were in Noland County, how he could be trusted to show up in court any time he was needed, and so on. It was just a garden variety marital dispute, and things could be worked out without getting the judicial system further involved. As he rambled, Phoebe eased into the courtroom and sat beside Annette. Her hands were trembling, her eyes moist. Richard, for the prosecution, dwelt on the gravity of the charges and the real possibility of a lengthy jail term for Fanning. "Nonsense," said Hump. "His man was innocent. His man had been attacked by his unbalanced wife. If she insisted on pushing matters, she just might be the one going to jail." Back and forth, the lawyers argued. The judge, a peaceful old gentleman with a slick head, asked calmly, "I understand the alleged victim is here in the courtroom. Is that correct, Ms. Brevard?" he asked, scanning the audience. Annette jumped to her feet and said, "She's right here, Your Honor." She walked through the bar as if she owned the courtroom, Phoebe in tow. "We represent Phoebe Fanning, whose divorce will be filing within the next 10 minutes. Samantha, still safely in the audience, watched as Randy Fanning glared at his wife. Richard seized the moment and said, "Your Honor, it might be helpful to notice the apparent wounds to the face of Mrs. Fanning. This woman has had the hell beaten out of her." "I'm not blind," replied the judge. "I don't see any damage to your face, Mr. Fanning. The court also takes note of the fact that you're over 6 feet tall and rather Stout. Your wife is, let's say, quite a bit smaller. Did you slap her around? Randy shuffled his considerable weight from foot to foot, obviously guilty, and managed to say, We had a fight, Judge. She started it. I'm sure she did. I think it's best if you continue to settle down for a day or two. I'm sending you back to jail, and we'll meet again on Thursday. In the meantime, Ms. Brevard, you and your client tend to her pressing legal matters and keep me posted. Hump said, But, Your Honor, my client will lose his job. Phoebe blurted, He doesn't have a job. He cuts timber part-time and sells meth full-time. Everyone seemed to swallow hard as her words rattled around the courtroom. Randy was ready to resume the fight and glared at his wife with murderous hatred. The judge finally said, That's enough. Bring him back Thursday. A bailiff grabbed Randy and led him away and out of the courtroom. Standing at the main door were two men, a couple of ruffians with matted hair and tattoos. They stared at Annette, Samantha, and Phoebe as they walked by. In the hallway, Phoebe whispered, Those thugs are with Randy, all in the meth business. I gotta get out of this town. Samantha thought, I might be right behind you. They walked into the office of the circuit court and filed the divorce. Annette was asking for an immediate hearing for a restraining order to keep Randy away from the family. The earliest slot is Wednesday afternoon, a clerk said. We'll take it, Annette said. The two thugs were waiting just outside the front door of the courthouse, and they had been joined by a third angry young man. He stepped in front of Phoebe and growled, You better drop the charges, girl, or you'll be sorry. Phoebe did not back away. Instead, she looked at him in a way that conveyed years of familiarity and contempt. She said to Annette, This is Randy's brother, Tony, fresh from prison. Did you hear me? I said drop the charges, Tony said in a louder growl. I just filed for divorce, Tony. It's over. I'm leaving town as fast as I can, but I'll be sure and come back when he goes to court. I'm not dropping the charges, so please get out of the way. One thug stared at Samantha, the other at Annette. The brief confrontation ended when Hump and Richard walked out of the courthouse and saw what was happening. That's enough, Richard said, and Tony backed away. Hump said, Let's go, gals. I'll walk you back to the office. As Hump lumbered down Main Street, talking nonstop about another case he and Annette were contesting, Samantha followed along, rattled by the incident and wondering if she needed a handgun in her purse. No wonder Donovan practiced law with a small arsenal. The rest of her afternoon was client-free, thankfully. She had heard enough misery for one day, and she needed to study. Annette loaned her some well-used seminar materials designed for rookie lawyers, with sections on divorce and domestic relations, wills and estates, bankruptcy, landlord and tenant, employment, immigration, and government assistance. A section on black lung benefits had been added later. It was dry and dull, at least to read about. But she had already learned firsthand that the cases were anything but boring. At 5 o'clock, she finally called Mr. Joe Duncan and informed him she could not handle his Social Security appeal. Her bosses prohibited such representation. She passed along the names of two private attorneys who took such cases and wished him well. He was not too happy with the call. She stopped by Maddie's office, and they recapped her first day on the job. So far, so good, though she was still rattled by the brief confrontation on the courthouse steps. They won't mess with a lawyer, Maddie assured her, especially a girl. I've been doing this for 26 years, and I've never been assaulted. Congratulations. Have you been threatened? Maybe a couple of times, but nothing that really scared me. You'll be fine. She felt fine leaving the office and walking to her car, though she couldn't help but glance around. A light mist was falling, and the town was growing darker. She parked in the garage under her apartment and climbed the steps. Annette's daughter, Kim, was 13. Her son, Adam, was 10. They were intrigued by their new roommate and insisted that she join them at mealtime. But Samantha had no plans to crash their dinner every night. With her crazy schedule and Blythe's, she had grown accustomed to eating alone. As a professional with a stressful job, Annette had little time to cook. Evidently, cleaning was not a priority either. Dinner was mac and cheese from the microwave, with sliced tomatoes from a client's garden. They drank water from plastic bottles, never from the tap. As they ate, the kids peppered Samantha with questions about her life, growing up in D.C., living and working in New York, and why in the world she had chosen to come to Brady. They were bright, confident, easy to humor, and not afraid to ask personal questions. They were courteous, too, never failing to say, "Yes, ma'am," and "No, ma'am." They decided she was too young to be called Miss Kofor, and Adam felt as though Samantha was too much of a mouthful. They eventually agreed on Miss Sam, though Samantha was hopeful the Miss would soon disappear. She told them that she would be their babysitter, and this seemed to puzzle them. "Why do we need one?" Kim asked. "So your mother can go out and do whatever she wants to do," Samantha said. "They found this amusing," Adam said. "But she never goes out." "True," Annette said. "There's not much to do in Brady. In fact, there's nothing to do if you don't go to church 3 nights a week." "And you don't go to church?" Samantha asked. So far, in her brief time in Appalachia, she had become convinced that every 5 families had their own tiny church with a leaning white steeple. There were churches everywhere, all believing in the inerrancy of the Holy Scripture, but evidently agreeing on little else. "Sometimes on Sunday," Kim said. After supper, Kim and Adam dutifully cleared the table and stacked the dishes in the sink. There was no dishwasher. They wanted to watch television with Miss Sam and ignore their homework, but Annette eventually shooed them off to the small bedrooms. Sensing that her guest might be getting bored, Annette said, "Let's have some tea and talk." With nothing else to do, Samantha said yes. Annette scooped up a pile of dirty clothes and tossed them into the clothes washer beside the refrigerator. She added soap and cranked a dial. "The noise will drown out anything we say," she said as she reached into a cabinet for tea bags. "Decaf okay?" "Sure," Samantha said as she stepped into the den, a room overrun with sagging bookshelves, stacks of magazines, and soft furniture that had not been dusted in months. In one corner there was a flat-screen TV. The garage apartment did not have one. And in another corner, Annette kept a small desk with a computer and a stack of files. She brought 2 cups of steaming tea, handed one to Samantha, and said, "Let's sit on the sofa and talk about girl stuff." "Okay, what do you have in mind?" As they settled in, Annette said, "Well, sex for one. How often do you get laid in New York?" Samantha laughed at the frankness, then hesitated, as if she couldn't remember the last time. "It's not that wild, really. I mean, it is if you're in the game, but in my crowd, we work too much to have any fun. A night out for us is a nice dinner and drinks, after which I'm always too tired to do anything but go to sleep. Alone." "That's hard to believe. All those rich young professionals on the prowl. I've watched Sex and the City. Over and over. By myself, of course. After the kids go to bed." "Well, I haven't. I've heard about it, but I'm usually at the office. I've had one boyfriend in the past 3 years. Henry, a starving actor. Really cute and fun in the sack, but he got tired of my hours and my fatigue. Sure, you meet a lot of guys, but most of them are just as driven. Women are disposable. A lot of jerks, too. A lot of arrogant brats who talk of nothing but money and brag about what they can buy. I'm crushed. Don't be. It's not as glamorous as you think. Never? Oh, sure, the occasional hookup, but nothing I care to remember. Samantha sipped her tea and wanted to shift the conversation. What about you? You get much action in Brady? It was Annette's turn to laugh. She paused, took a sip, and became sad. There's not much happening here. I made the choice. Now I live it. And that's okay. The choice? Yes, I came here 10 years ago, in full retreat. My divorce was a nightmare, and I had to get away from my ex. Get my kids away, too. He has almost no contact. Now, I'm 45 years old, somewhat attractive, in fairly good shape. Unlike, well, got it. Let's just say there's not much competition in Nolan County. There have been a couple of nice men along the way, but no one I wanted to live with. One guy was 20 years older. I just couldn't do that to my kids. For the first few years, it seemed as though half the women in town were trying to fix me up with a cousin. Then I realized they really wanted me to get married so they wouldn't have to worry about their own husbands. Married men, though, do not tempt me. Far too much trouble. Here, or in the city. Why do you stay? That's a great question. And I'm not sure I will. It's a safe place to raise kids, though we do worry about the environmental hazards. Brady's okay, but not far from here, back in the settlements and hollows. Kids are constantly sick from contaminated water and coal dust. To answer your question, I stayed because I love the work. I love the people who need my help. I can make a small difference in their lives. You met them today. You saw their fear and hopelessness. They need me. If I leave, there may be someone to take my place. And maybe not. How do you turn it off when you leave the office? I can't always do that. Their problems are too personal, so I lose a lot of sleep. I'm glad to hear that because I keep thinking about Phoebe Fanning, with her busted face and kids hidden with a relative and a goon for a husband who will probably kill her when he gets out. Annette offered a caring smile. I've seen a lot of women in her situation, and they've all survived. Phoebe will be fine, eventually. She'll relocate somewhere. We'll help her. And she'll divorce him. Keep in mind, Samantha, he's in jail right now, getting a good taste of life behind bars. If he does something stupid, he could spend the rest of his days in prison. I didn't get the impression he's that much of a thinker. You're right. He's an idiot and an addict. I'm not making light of her situation, but she'll be okay. Samantha exhaled and set her cup on the coffee table. I'm sorry. This is just so new to me. Dealing with real people? Yes. So caught up in their problems and expected to fix them. The last file I worked on in New York involved a really shady guy, worth about $1 billion or so. Our client, who wanted to build this very tall and sleek hotel in the middle of Greenwich Village. It was by far the ugliest model I ever saw. Really gaudy. He fired 3 or 4 architects, and his building just got taller and uglier. The city said hell no. So he sued and cozied up to the politicians and conducted himself like a lot of Manhattan developers. I met him once, briefly, when he came to the office to yell at my partner. A total sleazeball. And he was our client. My client. I detested the man. I wanted him to fail. And why not? He did fail, and we were secretly thrilled. Imagine that. We put in tons of hours, charged the guy a fortune, and felt like celebrating when his project got rejected. How's that for client relations? I'd celebrate too. Now I'm worried about Lady Purvis, whose husband is serving time in a debtor's prison, and I'm fretting about Phoebe getting out of town before her husband is free on bond. Welcome to our world, Samantha. There'll be even more tomorrow. I'm not sure I'm cut out for this. Yes, you are. You gotta be tough in this business. And you're a lot tougher than you think. Adam was back, homework suddenly finished, and he wanted to challenge Miss Sam to a game of gin rummy. He thinks he's a card shark, Annette said. And he cheats. I've never played gin rummy, Miss Sam said. Adam was shuffling the deck like a Vegas dealer. Chapter 10. Most of Maddie's workdays began with coffee at 8 o'clock sharp, office door closed, phone ignored, and Donovan sitting across from her, sharing the latest gossip. There was really no need to close her door, because no one else arrived for work until around 8:30, when Annette punched in after dropping her kids off at school. Nonetheless, Maddie treasured the privacy with her nephew and protected it. Office rules and procedures appeared to be lax, and Samantha had been told to show up around 9 and work until she found a good stopping place late in the afternoon. At first, she worried that the transition from 100 hours a week to 40 might be difficult, but not so. She had not slept until 7 in years and was finding it quite agreeable. By 8, however, she was climbing the walls and eager to start the day. On Tuesday, she eased through the front door, passed Maddie's office, heard low voices, and checked the kitchen for the coffee pot. She had just settled behind her compact desk for an hour or two of studying, or until she was fetched to sit through another client interview, when Donovan suddenly appeared and said, "Welcome to town." "Well, hello," she said. He glanced around and said, "I'll bet your office in New York was a lot bigger." "Not really. They stuffed us rookies into what they called quads, these cramped little workspaces where you could reach over and touch your colleague if you needed to. They saved on rent so the partners could protect their bottom line." "Sounds like you really miss it." "I think I'm still numb." She waved at the only other chair and said, "Have a seat." Donovan casually folded himself into the small chair and said, "Maddie tells me you made it to court on your very first day." "I did." "What else did she tell you?" Samantha wondered if her daily movements would be recapped each morning over their coffee. "Nothing. Just the idle chatter of small-town lawyers. Randy Fanning was once an okay guy. Then he got into meth. He'll wind up dead or in prison like a lot of guys around here." "Can I borrow one of your guns?" A laugh, then, "You won't need one. The meth dealers are not nearly as nasty as the coal companies. Start suing them all the time and I'll get you a gun. I know it's early, but have you thought about lunch?" "I haven't thought about breakfast yet." "I'm offering lunch, a working lunch in my office. Chicken salad sandwich." "How can I refuse that?" "Does noon work in your schedule?" She pretended to consult her busy daily planner and said, "Your lucky day. I happen to have an opening." He jumped to his feet and said, "See ya." She studied quietly for a while, hoping to be left undisturbed. Through the thin walls, she heard Annette discussing a case with Maddie. The phone rang occasionally, and each time Samantha held her breath and hoped that Barb would send the caller to another office, to a lawyer who knew what to do. Her luck lasted until almost 10, when Barb stuck her head around the door and said, "I'll be out for an hour. You have the front." She disappeared before Samantha could inquire as to what, exactly, that meant. It meant sitting at Barb's desk in the reception area, alone and vulnerable, and likely to be approached by some poor soul with no money to hire a real lawyer. It meant answering the phone and routing the calls to either Maddie or Annette, or simply stalling. One person asked for Annette, who was with a client. Another asked for Maddie, who had gone to court. Another needed advice on a Social Security disability claim. And Samantha happily referred him to a private firm. Finally, the front door opened, and Mrs. Francine Crump walked in with a legal matter that would haunt Samantha for months. All she wanted was a will, one that didn't cost anything. Simple wills are straightforward documents, the preparation of which can easily be undertaken by even the greenest of lawyers. Indeed, rookies jump at the chance to draft them, because it's difficult to screw them up. Suddenly confident, Samantha led Mrs. Crump back to a small meeting room and left the door open so she could keep an eye on the front. Mrs. Crump was 80 years old and looked all of it. Her husband died long ago, and her 5 children were scattered around the country, none close to home. She said she had been forgotten by them. They seldom came to visit, seldom called. She wanted to sign a simple will that gave them nothing. "Cut them all out," she said, with astonishing bitterness. Judging from her appearance and from the fact that she was looking for a free will, Samantha assumed that there was little in the way of assets. Mrs. Crump lived in Eufaula, a small community deep in Jacob's Holler. Samantha wrote this down as if she knew exactly where it was. There were no debts, nothing in the way of real assets, except for an old house and 80 acres, land that had been in her family forever. "Any idea what the land is worth?" Samantha asked. Mrs. Crump crunched her dentures and said, "A lot more than anybody knows. You see, the coal company came out last year and tried to buy the land. Been trying for some time, but I ran them off again. Ain't selling to no coal company. No, ma'am. They're blasting away not far from my land, taking down Cat Mountain. And it's a real shame. Ain't got no use for no coal company." "How much did they offer?" "A lot. And I ain't told my kids either. Won't tell 'em. I'm in bad health, you see, and I'll be gone pretty soon. If my kids get the land, they'll sell to the coal company before I'm cold in the ground. That's exactly what they'll do. I know 'em." She reached into her purse and pulled out some folded papers. "Here's a will I signed 5 years ago. My kids took me down to a lawyer's office just down the street, and they made me sign it." Samantha slowly unfolded the papers and read the last will and testament of Francine Cooper Crump. The third paragraph left everything to her 5 children in equal shares. Samantha scribbled some useless notes and said, "Okay, Mrs. Crump, for estate tax purposes, I need to know the approximate value of this land."
"The what?"
"How much did the coal company offer you?" She looked as if she'd been insulted, then leaned in low and whispered,
$200,000 and change. But it's worth double that. Maybe triple. You can't trust a coal company. They lowball everybody. Then figure out ways to steal from you at the end."
Suddenly, the simple will was not so simple. Samantha proceeded cautiously, asking, "All right, so who gets the 80 acres under a new will?"
"I want to give it to my neighbor, Jolene. She lives across the creek on her own land. And she ain't selling either. I trust her. And she's already promised to take care of my land."
"You've discussed this with her?"
"Talk about it all the time. She and her husband, Hank, say they'll make new wills too, and leave their land to me in case they go first. But they're in better health, you know. I figure I'll pass first." But what if they pass first? I doubt it. I got high blood pressure and a bad heart, plus bursitis. Sure, but what if they pass first and you inherit their land to go along with your land, and then you die? Who gets all this land? Not my kids. And not their kids either. God help us. You think mine are bad? Got that. But someone has to inherit the land. Who do you have in mind? That's what I came here for. To talk to a lawyer. I need some advice on what to do. Suddenly, with assets on the line, there were different scenarios. The new will would certainly be contested by the five children. And other than what she had just skimmed in the seminar materials, Samantha knew nothing about will contests. She vaguely recalled a case or two from a class in law school, but that seemed like so long ago. She managed to stall, take notes, and ask semi-relevant questions for half an hour, and succeeded in convincing Mrs. Crump that she should return in a few days after the firm had reviewed her situation. Barb was back, and she proved skillful in helping to ease the new client out the front door. "What was that all about?" Barb asked when Mrs. Crump was gone. "I'm not sure. I'll be in my room." Donovan's office was in much better shape than the legal aid clinic's. Leather chairs, thick rugs, hardwood floors with a nice finish. A funky chandelier hung in the center of the foyer. Samantha's first thought was that, finally, there was someone in Brady who might be making a buck or two. His receptionist, Dawn, greeted her politely and said the boss was waiting upstairs. She was off to lunch. As she climbed the circular staircase, Samantha heard the front door close and lock. There was no sign of anyone else. Donovan was on the phone behind a large wooden desk that appeared to be very old. He waved her in, pointed to a bulky chair, and said, "Gotta go." He slammed the phone down and said, "Welcome to my domain. This is where all the long balls are hit." "Nice," she said, looking around. The room was large and opened onto the balcony. The walls were covered with handsome bookcases, all packed with the usual assortment of treatises and thick tomes meant to impress. In one corner was a gun rack, displaying at least 8 deadly weapons. Samantha didn't know a shotgun from a deer rifle, but the collection appeared to be primed and ready. "Guns everywhere," she observed. "I hunt a lot. Always have. When you grow up in these mountains, you grow up in the woods. I killed my first deer at the age of 6, with a bow." "Congratulations. And why do you want to have lunch?" "You promised, remember? Last week, just after you were arrested and I rescued you from jail." "But we agreed on lunch at the diner down the street. I thought we might have more privacy here. Plus, I try and avoid the local spots. As I told you, there are a lot of people around here who don't like me. Sometimes they say things and make a scene in public. It can really ruin a good lunch." "I don't see any food." "It's in the war room. Come with me." He jumped to his feet, and she followed him down a short hallway to a long, windowless room. At one end of a cluttered table, there were 2 plastic carry-out containers and 2 bottles of water. He pointed and said, "Lunch is served." Samantha walked to a side wall and stared at an enlarged photo that was at least 8 feet tall. It was in color, and it portrayed a scene that was shocking and tragic. A massive boulder, the size of a small car, had crashed through a mobile home, shearing it in half and causing serious damage. "What's this?" she asked. Donovan stepped beside her and said, "Well, it's a lawsuit to begin with. For about 1 million years, that boulder was part of Enid Mountain, about 40 miles from here, over in Hopper County. A couple of years ago, they began strip mining the mountain, blew its top off, and dug out the coal. On March 14th of last year, at 4 a.m, a bulldozer owned and operated by a roguish outfit called Strayhorn Coal was clearing rock, without a permit, and this boulder was shoved into the fill area down the valley. Because of its size, it picked up momentum as it descended along the steep creek bed. He was pointing to an enlarged map next to the photo. Almost a mile from where it left the blade of the bulldozer, it crashed into this little trailer. In the back bedroom were two brothers, Eddie Tate, age 11, and Brandon Tate, age 8. Sound asleep, as you might expect.
Their father was in prison for cooking meth.
Their mother was at work at a convenience store. The boys were killed instantly. Crushed. Flattened. Samantha gawked at the photo in disbelief.
That's horrible.
Indeed it was. And is. Life near a strip mine is never dull. The ground shakes and cracks foundations. Coal dust fills the air and blankets everything. The well water turns orange. Rocks fly all the time. I had a case 2 years ago in West Virginia where a Mr. and Mrs. Hertzog were sitting by their small pool on a warm Saturday afternoon, and a one-ton boulder came from nowhere and landed square in the middle of the pool. They got drenched. The pool cracked. We sued the company and got a few bucks, but not much.
And you've sued Strayhorn Coal?
Oh, yes. We go to trial next Monday in Colton, Circuit Court. The company won't settle? The company was fined by our fearless regulators. Hit 'em hard for $20,000, which they have appealed. No, they won't settle. They, along with their insurance company, have offered $100,000.
$100,000 for two dead kids?
Dead kids are not worth much.
Especially in Appalachia.
They have no economic value because they, obviously, are not employed. It's a great case for punitive damages. Strayhorn Coal is capitalized at $500 million, and I'll ask for $1 million or $2 million. But the wise people who make the laws in Virginia decided years ago to cap punitive damages. I think I remember this from the bar exam. The cap is $350,000, regardless of how bad the defendant acted. It was a gift from our General Assembly to the insurance industry, like all caps.
You sound like my father.
You want to eat or stand here for the next hour?
I'm not sure I'm hungry.
Well, I am. They sat at the table and unwrapped their sandwiches. Samantha took a small bite but had no appetite.
Have you tried to settle the case? She asked.
I put $1 million on the table. They countered with $100,000. So we're miles apart. They, the insurance lawyers, along with the coal company, are banking on the fact that the family was screwed up and not that close. They're also banking on the fact that a lot of jurors in these parts are either afraid of big coal or quietly supportive of it.
When you sue a coal company in Appalachia, you can't always count on an unbiased jury.
Even those who despise the companies tend to stay quiet about it. Everybody has a relative or a friend who's got a job. It makes for some interesting dynamics in the courtroom. Samantha tried another small bite and looked around the room. The walls were covered with enlarged color photos and maps, some marked as trial exhibits, others apparently waiting for trial. She said, "This reminds me of my father's office, once upon a time." Marshall Kofer. I checked him out. He was quite the trial lawyer in his day.
Yes, he was. When I was a kid, if I wanted to see him, I usually had to go to his office,
if he was in town. He worked nonstop, ran a big firm. When he wasn't jetting around the world chasing the latest aviation disaster, he was in his office preparing for trial. They had this large, cluttered room. Come to think of it, they called it the war room. I didn't invent the term. Most trial lawyers have one. And the walls were covered with large photos and diagrams and all sorts of exhibits.
It was impressive, even to a kid. I can still feel the tension, the anxiety in the room as he and his staff got ready for the courtroom. These were big crashes with lots of dead people, lots of lawyers and all. He explained later that most of his cases were settled right before trial. Liability was seldom an issue. The plane went down. It wasn't the fault of the passengers. The airlines have plenty of money and insurance, and they worry about their image, so they settle for huge sums. Did you ever consider working with him? No, never. He's impossible. Or at least he was back then. Massive ego, total workaholic, pretty much of an ass. I wanted no part of his world. Then he crashed himself. Indeed he did. She stood and walked to another photo, one of a mangled car. Rescue personnel were trying to remove someone trapped inside. Donovan kept his seat and chewed on a chip. He said, "I tried that case in Martin County, West Virginia, 3 years ago. Lost." "What happened?" "A coal truck came down the mountain, overweight and speeding, and it veered across the center line and ran over that little Honda. The driver was Gretchen Bain, age 16, my client, and she died at the scene. If you look closely, you can see her left foot at the bottom there, sort of hanging out the door. I was afraid of that." "Did the jury see this?" "Oh, yes. They saw everything. For 5 days, I laid it all out for the jury, but it didn't matter." "How did you lose?" "I lose about half of them. In that case, the truck driver took the stand, swore to tell the truth, then lied for 3 hours. He said Gretchen crossed the center line and caused the wreck, made it sound as though she was trying to kill herself. The coal companies are clever, and they never send down one truck at a time. They travel in pairs, so there's always a witness ready to testify. Trucks hauling coal that weighs 100 tons, racing across old 20-ton bridges still used by school buses, and absolutely ignoring every rule of the road. If there's an accident, it's usually bad. In West Virginia, they're killing one innocent driver per week. The trucker swears he was doing nothing wrong. His buddy backs him up. There are no other witnesses. So the jury falls in line with Big Coal." "Can't you appeal?" Donovan laughed as though she'd nailed her punchline. He took a swig of water and said, "Sure, we still have that right. But West Virginia elects its judges, which is an abomination. Virginia has some screwed up laws, but at least we don't elect judges. Not so over there. There are 5 members of the West Virginia Supreme Court. They serve 4-year terms and run for re-election. Guess who contributes the big money to the campaigns?" "The coal companies." "Bingo." "They influence the politicians, the regulators, the judges, and they often control the juries. So it's not exactly an ideal climate for us litigators." "So much for a fair trial," she said, still looking at the photos. "We win occasionally. In Gretchen's case, we got a break. 1 month after the trial, the same driver hit another car. Luckily, no one was killed, just a few broken bones. The deputy on the scene got curious and took the driver in for questioning. He was acting weird and finally admitted he'd been driving for 15 hours straight. To help matters, he was drinking Red Bull with vodka and snorting crystal meth. The deputy turned on a recorder and quizzed him about the Bain accident. He admitted he'd been threatened into lying by his employer. I got a copy of the transcript and filed a bunch of motions. The court finally granted a new trial, one we're still waiting for. Eventually, I'll nail them." "What happened to the driver?" "He became a whistleblower and spilled the beans on East Point Mining, his employer. Someone slashed his tires and fired 2 shots through his kitchen window. So he's now in hiding.
in another state. I give him cash to live on.
Is that legal?
That's not a fair question in coal country. Nothing is black and white in my world. The enemy breaks every rule in the book, so the fight is never fair. If you play by the rules, you lose, even when you're on the right side. She returned to the table and nibbled on a chip. She said, I knew I was wise to avoid litigation. I hate to hear that, he said, smiling, his dark eyes absorbing every move she made. I was thinking about offering you a job. I'm sorry? I'm serious. I could use some research, and I'll pay you. I know how much you're earning over at the legal clinic, so I figured you might want to moonlight as a research assistant. Here, in your office. Where else? Nothing that would interfere with your internship. Strictly after hours and on weekends. If you're not already bored here in Brady, it won't be long. Why me? There's no one else. I have two paralegals and one is leaving tomorrow. I can't trust any other lawyer in town, nor anyone from any law office. I'm paranoid about secrecy. And you obviously haven't been here long enough to know anything or anybody. You're the perfect hire. I don't know what to say. Have you talked to Maddie? Not about this, no. But if you're interested, I'll have a chat with her. She rarely says no to me. Think about it. If you don't want to, I'll understand completely. Okay, I'll think about it. But I've just started one job and wasn't planning on looking for another. Not so soon, anyway. Plus, I really don't like litigation. You won't have to go to court. Just hide in here, do the research, write the briefs, work the long hours you're accustomed to working. I was trying to get away from that. I understand. Mull it over and we'll chat later. They worked on their sandwiches for a moment, but the silence was too heavy. Samantha finally said, Maddie told me about your past. He smiled and shoved his food away. What do you want to know? I'm an open book. She doubted that. She could think of several questions. What happened to your father? How serious is the separation from your wife? How often do you see her? Maybe later. She said, Nothing, really. It's an interesting background. That's all. Interesting, sad, tragic, filled with adventure. All of the above. I'm 38 years old, and I'll die young. She could think of no response. Chapter 11. The highway to Colton snaked through the mountains, rising and falling, offering breathtaking views of the dense ridges, then dipping into valleys filled with clusters of dilapidated shacks and mobile homes, with junk cars scattered about. It clung to creeks with shallow rapids and water clear enough to drink. And just as the beauty sunk in, it passed another settlement of tiny forlorn houses stuck close together and shaded eternally by the mountains. The contrast was startling. The beauty of the ridges against the poverty of the people who lived between them. There were some pretty homes with neat lawns and white picket fences, but the neighbors were usually not as prosperous. Maddie drove and talked while Samantha took in the scenery. As they climbed a stretch of road, a rare straightaway, a long truck approached from the other direction. It was dirty, covered with dust, with a canvas top over its bed. It was flying down the mountain, obviously speeding, but staying in the proper lane. After it passed, Samantha said, I assume that was a coal truck? Maddie checked a mirror as though she hadn't noticed. Oh, yes. They haul it out after it's been washed and it's ready for the market. They're everywhere. Donovan talked about them yesterday, He doesn't think too highly of them. I'll bet good money that truck was overweight and probably couldn't pass inspection.
And no one checks them?
It's spotty. And usually when the inspectors arrive, the coal companies already know they're coming. My favorites are the mine safety inspectors who monitor the blasting. They have a schedule, so when they show up at a strip mine, guess what? Everything is by the book. As soon as they leave, the company blasts away with little regard for the rules.
Samantha assumed Maddie knew everything about her lunch the day before with Donovan. She waited a moment to see if the job offer was mentioned. It was not. They topped a mountain and began another descent. Maddie said,
"Let me show you something. Won't take but a minute."
She hit the brakes and turned onto a smaller highway, one with more curves and steeper ridges. They were going up again. A sign said a picnic area with a scenic view was just ahead. They stopped at a small strip of land with two wooden tables and a garbage can. Before them lay miles of rolling mountains covered with dense hardwoods. They got out of the car and walked to a rickety fence built to keep people and vehicles from tumbling deep into a valley where they would never be found.
Maddie said, "This is a good spot to see mountaintop removal from a distance. Three sites." She pointed to her left. "That's the Cat Mountain Mine not far from Brady. Straight ahead is the Loose Creek Mine in Kentucky. And to the right there is the Little Utah Mine, also in Kentucky. All active, all stripping coal as fast as humanly possible. Those mountains were once 3,000 feet high, like their neighbors. Look at them now." They were scalped of all greenery and reduced to rock and dirt. Their tops were gone, and they stood like missing fingers, the nubs on a mangled hand. They were surrounded by unspoiled mountains, all ablaze with the orange and yellow of mid-autumn, and perfectly beautiful, if not for the eyesores across the ridge. Samantha stood motionless, staring in disbelief, and trying to absorb the devastation. She finally said, "This can't be legal." "Afraid so, according to federal law. Technically, it's legal. But the way they go about it is quite illegal."
"There's no way to stop it?"
"Litigation is still raging. Has been for 20 years. We've had a few victories at the federal level, but all the good decisions have been overturned on appeal. The Fourth Circuit is loaded with Republican appointees. We're still fighting, though."
"We?"
"The good guys, the opponents of strip mining. I'm not personally involved as a lawyer, but I'm on the right team. We're in a distinct minority around here, but we're fighting."
Maddie glanced at her watch and said, "We'd better go." Back in the car, Samantha said, "Kinda makes you sick, doesn't it?"
"Yes, they've destroyed so much of our way of life here in Appalachia. So, yes, it makes me sick."
As they entered the town of Colton, the highway became Center Street, and after a few blocks, the courthouse appeared on the right. Samantha said,
"Donovan has a trial here next week."
"Oh, yes, a big one. Those two little boys. So sad."
"You know the case?"
"Oh, yes. It was quite the story when they were killed. I know more than I care to know. I just hope he wins. I advised him to settle, to take something for the family, but he wants to make a statement."
"So he doesn't take your advice?"
"Donovan usually does what he wants to do. And he's usually right."
They parked behind the courthouse and walked inside. Unlike Nolan County's, the Hopper County Courthouse was a baffling modern structure that had undoubtedly once looked thrilling on paper. All glass and rock, it jutted here and folded there, and wasted a lot of space in its daring design. Samantha figured the architect had eventually lost his license.
"The old one burned," Maddie said as they climbed the stairs.
"But then they all burn,"
Samantha wasn't sure what this meant.
Lady Purvis was sitting nervously in the hallway outside the courtroom, and she smiled with great relief when she saw her lawyers. A few others loitered about, waiting for court to convene. After a few preliminaries, Lady pointed to a dough-faced young man in a polyester sports coat and shiny boots with pointed toes.
That's him. Works for JRA. Named Snowden. Laney Snowden.
Wait here, Maddie said. With Samantha following her, she made a beeline for Mr. Snowden, whose eyes got bigger the closer she got.
You're the representative for JRA, Maddie demanded.
I am, Snowden said proudly. She thrust a card at him, as if it were a switchblade, and said,
I'm Maddie Wyatt, attorney for Stocky Purvis.
This is my associate, Samantha Kofer. We've been hired to get our client out of jail. Snowden took a step back as Maddie pressed ahead.
Samantha, treading water, wasn't sure what to do, so she quickly adopted an aggressive posture and look.
She scowled at Snowden as he looked blankly at her and tried to absorb the reality that a deadbeat like Stocky Purvis could hire not one but two lawyers.
Fine, Snowden said. Fork over the money and we'll get him out.
He doesn't have any money, Mr. Snowden. That much should be clear by now. And he can't make any money as long as you've got him locked up in jail. Tack on all the illegal fees you want, but the truth is, my client can't earn a dime sitting where he's sitting right now.
I have a court order, Snowden said with bravado.
Well, we're about to talk to the judge about his court order. It's going to be amended so Stocky walks. If you don't negotiate, you'll get left holding the bag.
Okay, what do you gals have in mind?
Don't call me a gal, Maddie barked at him. Snowden recoiled fearfully, as if he might get hit with one of those sexual harassment claims you read about. Maddie, inching closer to Snowden as her face changed colors, said,
Here's the deal. My client owes the county about $200 in fines and fees. You boys have tacked on 400 more for your own fun and games. We'll pay 100 of that, total of 300 max, and we'll have 6 months to pay it. That's it. Take it or leave it.
Snowden put on a phony smile, shook his head and said,
Sorry, Miss Wyatt, but we can't live with that.
Without taking her eyes off Snowden, Maddie reached into her briefcase and whipped out some papers.
Then try living with this, she said, waving the papers in his face. It's a lawsuit to be filed in federal court against Judicial Response Associates. I'll add you later as a defendant for wrongful arrest and wrongful imprisonment. You see, Mr. Snowden, the Constitution says quite clearly that you cannot imprison a poor person for failing to pay his debts. I don't expect you to know this because you work for a bunch of crooks. However, trust me on this. The federal judges understand it because they've read the Constitution, most of them anyway. Debtors' prisons are illegal. Ever heard of the Equal Protection Clause?
Snowden's mouth was open, but words failed him. She pressed on.
Didn't think so. Maybe your lawyers can explain it at $300 an hour. I'm telling you so you can tell your bosses that I'll keep you in court for the next 2 years. I'll drown you in paperwork. I'll drag your asses through hours of depositions and discover all your dirty little tricks. It'll all come out. I'll hound you into the ground and make your lives miserable. You'll have nightmares about me. And in the end, I'll win the case. Plus, I'll collect attorney's fees.
She pushed the lawsuit into his chest, and he reluctantly took it. They wheeled about and marched away, leaving Snowden weak-kneed and shell-shocked, and already having glimpses of the nightmares. Samantha, stunned in her own way, whispered,
Can't we bankrupt the $300?
Suddenly composed, Maddie said with a grin,
Of course we can. And we will.
30 minutes later, Maddie stood before the judge
and announced that they had reached a deal for the immediate release of her client, Mr. Stocky Purvis. Lady was in tears as she left the courthouse and headed for the jail. Driving back to Brady, Maddie said, "A license to practice law is a powerful tool, Samantha, when it's used to help little people. Crooks like Snowden are accustomed to bullying folks who can't afford representation. But you get a good lawyer involved, and the bullying stops immediately. You're a pretty good bully yourself." "I've had practice." "When did you prepare the lawsuit?" "We keep them in inventory. The file is actually called Dummy Lawsuits. Just plug in a different name, splash the words federal court all over it, and they scatter like squirrels." Dummy lawsuits, scattering like squirrels. Samantha wondered how many of her classmates at Columbia had been exposed to such legal tactics. At 2 that afternoon, Samantha was sitting in the main courtroom of the Nolan County Courthouse, patting the knee of a terrified Phoebe Fanning. Her facial wounds had now turned dark blue and looked even worse. She had arrived at court with a thick layer of makeup, which Annette didn't approve of. She instructed their client to go to the restroom and scrub it off. Once again, Randy Fanning was driven over with his escort and entered the courtroom looking even rougher than he had 2 days earlier. He had been served a copy of the divorce and appeared perturbed by it. He glared at his wife and at Samantha as a deputy removed his handcuffs. The circuit court judge was Jeb Battle, an eager youngster who looked no more than 30. Since the legal aid clinic handled a lot of domestic work, Annette was a regular and claimed to get on well with his honor. The judge called things to order and approved a few uncontested matters while they waited. When he called Fanning versus Fanning, Annette and Samantha moved with their client through the bar to a table near the bench. Randy Fanning walked to another table, with a deputy close by, and waited for Hump to waddle into place. Judge Battle looked closely at Phoebe, at her bruised face, and without saying a word, made his decision. He said, "This divorce was filed Monday. Have you been served a copy, Mr. Fanning? You may remain seated."
"Yes, sir, I have a copy."
"Mr. Humphrey, I understand a bond will be set in the morning, is that right?"
"Yes, sir."
"We are here on a motion for a temporary restraining order. Phoebe Fanning is asking the court to order Randall Fanning to stay away from the couple's residence, the couple's 3 children, Phoebe herself, and anyone in her immediate family. Do you object to this, Mr. Humphrey?"
"Of course we do, Your Honor. This matter is getting blown way out of proportion."
Hump was on his feet, waving his hands dramatically, his voice getting twangier with each sentence.
"The couple had a fight, and it's not the first.